From Spark and Anvil and Gambit Tales, this is King Pumble and King Sable in Chapter 1 of the Gambit Tales cast. This drama uses an AI-generated voice, voiced via Gemini 2.5. Across the river from each other, on the morning of the academy visit, the two kings are doing what they have been doing every morning for as long as they have been kings, which is to say, since they were children, since the gardens and the library and the slow, careful hands of the people who raised them taught them the only kind of motion their lives would ever ask of them. In the library tower above Merrillbridge, King Pumble is reshelving books. He has been at the task since before sunrise, when the east window first began to color, and he moves now from the long oak table to the wall shelf with the deliberate weight of a man who knows perfectly well that a shelf in the wrong order is a year of his apprentice's work undone. He holds a single rolled scroll between both hands as though it might break, and perhaps it might. Some of the older ones are brittle along the seams, and he has watched two crumble in the past 10 years for reasons that did not, at the time, feel survivable. He sets it on the shelf. He turns. He walks back to the table. One step. Another. He takes the next scroll. He does not rush. He learned not to rush a long time ago in two distinct lessons, the first when he was 19 and the scroll scattered, the second when he was 23 and they scattered again. And the lessons have never quite stopped instructing him. Now he moves the way the books need him to move, which is shelf to shelf, one shelf at a time, never two at once. His brass-rimmed reading glasses slide down his nose, the way they have been sliding down his nose since he started needing them at 41. He pushes them back up with a knuckle. He smiles at no one in particular, because there is no one in the library except him, and the scrolls and the slow widening of the morning light through the high east window, which has the disconcerting effect of making the room look, for an hour every day, like the inside of a polished honey jar. Across the contested river, in the maze garden of the Lesser Palace, King Sable is pruning. He stands at the first topiary, a wide, soft cone of dark hedge that has wanted, for the better part of a decade now, to be a sphere, and he makes one snip. He inspects the result with the kind of patience that one of his gardener uncles once described in his hearing as the patience of a man who does not believe in luck. He steps to the next hedge. One step. He makes one snip. He inspects. He does not snip twice in a row. He learned not to do that when he was 17. That was the first time, with the bay hedge, and again at 24, with the smaller of the two yew arches, both of which he lost to a second cut taken too soon. Now he moves the way the maze garden needs him to move, which is one hedge at a time, one cut per visit, never a second cut in haste. His worn straw hat shades his eyes. His garden shears hang from his belt between snips, the leather of the holster long ago shaped to their particular weight. He does not whistle. He has never been the whistling kind. The maze hums faintly in the morning warmth, all hedge and bird and the small dry sound of one snip per hedge, and somewhere on the far side of the maze, a wren is rehearsing a song it does not yet entirely have. At 10 o'clock, both kings set down their work, Pumble the scrolls, Sable the shears, and they each walk to the boathouse that the academy keeps at the river's middle bank, where a flat-bottomed crossing boat has waited since before either of them was born, for occasions of this exact kind. They cross from opposite sides. They meet at the academy door. They walk in together. They walk slowly, the way they always walk. The academy hall this morning has two thrones at the front of the room. They are not really thrones in any technical sense. They are two large wooden chairs that somebody, probably Captain Castle, has dragged out of the staff library and pushed up against the chalkboard with the practical air of a man arranging furniture for an event whose ceremony he has long ago stopped finding ceremonial. But the two kings sitting in them are very real, and the children sitting on the floor in front of them are looking up with the careful attention of children who have been told beforehand that today they will meet both kings at the same time. The two kings do not look anything alike. Pumble is on the left, in a green coat with too many buttons, which he keeps fiddling the way a man fiddles with anything within reach when he is trying not to be nervous. He is 62 years old. He has a kind round face and very tired eyes. He smiles when he is nervous, which is almost always.
Sable is on the right, in a dark gray coat with no buttons at all. He had them all removed last spring after deciding once and for all that he was tired of doing them up. He is 62 years old, exactly the same as Pumble, to the week. He has a thinner face, neat short white hair, and the small steady frown of a man who is not unhappy but is also not at this particular moment smiling. He never smiles when he is nervous. He simply waits, the way a chess piece waits for its move to come. A child in the front says, "Are you really cousins?" "Yes," says Pumble immediately, "and I am very glad to be. That is to say, I'm sorry, that's a strange way to put it. I just mean, yes, we are cousins. I love him, sorry." Sable says, after a small pause, "Yes." The child says, with the practical curiosity of someone who has been turning the question over for several days, "Whose mother was whose mother's sister?" Pumble blinks. He looks at Sable. Sable looks at Pumble. "His mother," says Sable, pointing across with a finger that does not so much point, indicate, "was my mother's sister." "And his father," Pumble adds, recovering, "was my father's brother." The child considers this. Several other children behind her also consider this. There is a small, thoughtful silence of the sort that happens when an entire room of 9 and 10-year-olds is briefly being asked to model the genealogy of two old men. Captain Castle, leaning against the doorframe at the back of the hall, sighs gently. He has explained this to children before. He has stopped trying to make it sound less unusual than it is. "This is unusual," Pumble says to the children, with great seriousness, "even in royal families. It led to a particular set of cheekbones that both my cousin and I still resent." Sable touches his own cheek and nods once. The children laugh, then a small boy near the back, with chalk on his sleeve, says, "Why do you both walk so slowly?" Pumble and Sable look at each other. Sable lifts a single eyebrow at his cousin, the way you lift a single eyebrow when somebody you have known for 62 years has just been asked exactly the right question by exactly the right child. Because, choosing his words with the care that has, over the years, become his only reliable currency, kings move one square at a time. We are practicing, all our lives. "And so are our kingdoms," Sable adds. The children look at their feet. Then they look at the square tiles of the Academy Hall floor. Several of them quietly try walking one tile at a time without picking up their feet too high. The kings watch this without comment, the way grown-ups watch children doing the small private experiment of becoming.
They were born in the same week of the same year, in two palaces on opposite sides of a river that the cartographers, to this day, have never quite agreed on the name of. Pumble was born during a thunderstorm. The wind shook the palace windows, and the midwife had to relight the lamps 3 times. He cried more or less continuously for the first hour, and was a quiet baby ever after, as if he had used up his entire allotment of crying on that first thunderstorm, and had decided, on the strength of some private accounting, that he had spent enough. Sable was born during a sunrise. The midwife at the other palace had been up all night, and was, by the time of the birth, in the kind of mood where nothing in the natural world was capable of surprising her. She delivered Sable with 3 words of conversation and a pot of tea on the side table. He did not cry. He simply looked at the morning light through the window with the polite expression of a person being introduced to someone he was expected to remember, and went to sleep. Their grandmother, who was the kind of person who made pronouncements, said when she heard about both births in the same week, "One will be loud and one will be quiet, and they will both move 1 careful step at a time, and so will their kingdoms, because the kingdoms will be theirs, and a king who hurries is a king who falls." She was, more or less, right. She was also, in her way, instructing the family. She had spent her own years as queen of the smaller kingdom learning the same lesson, that a crown is not a sprint, that to do the king's work is to do 1 thing at a time, and to do it before doing the next. She had been a librarian's daughter before she was a queen. She believed in the slowness of careful hands, the way other people believe in luck or weather, or the inevitability of one season giving way to the next. So she made arrangements, in the way that grandmothers who have been queens occasionally do. Pumble would be raised next to the library tower above Marrowbridge, among the scrolls and the long oak tables, and the librarian aunts who would teach him the patience of 1 shelf at a time. Sable would be raised next to the maize garden at the Lesser Palace, among the hedgerows and the gardener uncles who would teach him the patience of 1 snip per visit.
By the time the boys were 9, they could each do their work without scattering scrolls and without losing hedges. By the time they were 15, they could do it without thinking. By the time they were 30, they could not imagine doing it any other way. The two kingdoms had a long-standing diplomatic non-relationship. They were not at war, exactly, but they were also not entirely at peace, and any meeting between members of the royal houses required so many forms and so many treaties that nobody actually held them. The boys, who had heard about each other their entire childhoods and had not been allowed even a single letter, were not permitted to meet until they were 9. When they did meet on the neutral middle bank of the river, what each cousin recognized in the other was not at first family. It was cadence, the way the other one moved. One step, then another. Never rushed. Both of them, even at 9, already moving like kings, although neither of them had any official sense of what that meant, and would not for years. They got on, mostly because of this. They have got on ever since, mostly because of this. The grandmother, who watched the first meeting from a folding chair on the riverbank, was not surprised at the outcome. She had planned for it. She wrote later in a private letter to her own sister, "They have learned slowness from different gardens. They will be enough alike to trust each other, and enough different not to bore each other. This is the most I can give them, and I think it will turn out to be enough." She also, that same year, instituted what she called the letter game. Each week, on Sunday morning, each cousin would write a letter to the other. The letters could be about anything. The only rule was that they had to include one fact about the day and one fact about themselves. She personally read every letter for the first 6 years to make sure neither cousin was being lazy. She was a very thorough grandmother. After year 6, she trusted them. The letters went eventually to the post office at Merrimile. From there, they were carried, often by ranger messengers, sometimes by ordinary couriers, occasionally by a particularly determined trader who happened to be passing through, across the contested river to the other kingdom. The letter game taught the boys the same thing the library and the maze garden had taught them. One careful step a week is more than enough, if you keep stepping.
The letter game has, by now, been going on for 42 years. The kings have written each other approximately 2,184 letters. Their grandmother died 11 years ago, in her sleep, with a finished letter to her own sister on the bedside table. The cousins have not stopped writing. The two letter styles diverged early, and the divergences, if you look at it the right way, the rule on paper. Pumble's letters are warm and slightly worried. He asks a lot of questions. He apologizes for the questions. He apologizes for the apologies. They contain 6 or 7 distinct moves in a single letter. A thought, a worry, a small joke, an apology, a question, a goodbye, a postscript that reopens the question. Because Pumble has never quite learned to make one letter say one thing. He is, in this single small respect, still learning to be the king he is trying to be. He knows it. He keeps trying. He has written letters his entire life that say 6 things when one would have served him better. And he has, all 62 years of it, considered the failure his own and not the language's. Sable's letters are shorter, calmer, and occasionally devastating. They sometimes contain only one line. "The wheat came in, twice." That is the entire letter. One step, one square, one fact. He does not add a postscript. He does not apologize for the brevity. He has learned to write a letter the way he prunes a hedge. One snip per visit, no second cut in haste. And the discipline that took him decades on the topiary translated, somehow, almost effortlessly to paper. Pumble has been known to read these short letters 15 times in a row, trying to understand if Sable is angry. Sable is almost never angry. Sable is just doing what a king does, which is one thing per page. This is the divergence, and it is also the lesson. Pumble keeps every letter Sable has ever sent him in a small cedar chest at the foot of his bed. The chest is now full. He has this year ordered a second one. He has counted them, 2,112, and each one he has come to think of is one careful step Sable took on a Sunday. Sable keeps Pumble's letters in a slightly disorderly stack in a desk drawer. He has twice in his life gone back and reread every letter Pumble has ever sent him in chronological order. He has not told Pumble that he has done this. He is not entirely sure why. He suspects, accurately, that it would make Pumble cry. He is reluctant to be the cause of crying in a man who has cried enough. Each Pumble letter, when he rereads it, takes him 5 minutes. Not because the letter is long, but because Pumble keeps doubling back, retracting, apologizing, reaffirming.
Each letter is in Sable's private mental shorthand, Pumble trying to move one square and accidentally moving four at the same time. He loves Pumble for the trying. He loves him for the trying even more than for the eventual success. Captain Castle has read a sample of these letters with permission. The cousins gave him three each from the early years. He keeps them in a folder. He has told children more than once, "This is the King Rule," written down. Sable's letter is one careful step. Pumble's letter is the cost of forgetting the step. Both are honest, both belong to the game. This is, in a small way, the story of how Pumble and Sable have stayed friends despite leading enemy armies. It is also the story of how each cousin has spent 42 years practicing the one square at a time rule on a piece of paper before practicing it again on a board, and of how, between the two of them, they have made the practice of the rule into something close to an entire shared life. There is, however, a larger story, and it is one neither cousin tells very often.
When they were 37, both kingdoms were in trouble at the same time. Different troubles, on opposite sides of the same river, in the same brutal winter. The same brutal winter, in fact, that Queen Vesper rode across on a stolen horse. Yes, that one. The outposts that were overrun were each other's outposts. They held the same river crossing from opposite shores. The letters that Vesper carried, those urgent letters that arrived at Marrow Mile at the same time, were in different handwriting and different ink, and on different paper, the same letter. Each general had told each king the same thing in nearly the same words. "Your Majesty, the Eastern Crossing is the choke point. The kingdom rises and falls with you. If you fall, the kingdom falls. We must protect you." Pumble read his letter alone in the library tower. He set it down on the long oak table next to the scroll he had been about to reshelve. He stared at it for a long time, long enough that the morning light through the east window slid across the table from one side of the letter to the other. He had known, in some abstract way, that this was true of being a king. He had not, until that letter, felt it in his chest. He had not understood, until that letter, that the entire game of being a kingdom was protect the king or end the game. He had thought it was about armies. It is about armies. It is also, more deeply and more inconveniently, about him. He understood then why he could only move one square at a time. A king who could run would be lost in a week. A king who could leap would be cornered by Tuesday. The slowness was not a limitation. It had never been a limitation. The slowness was the gift. It was the architectural feature of the entire game, the thing that let the rest of the pieces, the queen who ran and the bishops who swept and the knights who jumped and the rooks who marched in straight lines, organized themselves around him. If he stayed still, they could move. If he moved carefully, they could move faster. He was the center of the gravity. He was the piece they were protecting, because the protection was the entire purpose. He had thought, until that letter, that the kingdom existed to defend him because he was important. He understood now, sitting at the long oak table with the light moving across the paper, that he was important because the kingdom needed something to defend, and that the king's slowness made the defending possible. The two facts were, in the end, the same fact, told from different sides. He cried, briefly, sitting at the long oak table. Then he stood up. He took one careful step to the shelf. He put the scroll back where it belonged. Then he took one careful step to his writing desk. He sat down. He wrote one careful sentence. "Cousin, I have just been asked to reinforce my Eastern Crossing. I will do it. I am sorry." Across the river, at the same hour, Sable read his version of the same letter in the maize garden. He read it standing up, between two hedges, with the garden shears still in his free hand. He read it twice. He did not cry. He is not the crying kind, and he had not been even as a child. But he set the shears down on the hedge edge, and he sat on the bench he kept at the maze's center for exactly this kind of moment. And he stayed there for what one of the gardeners later described as a long time. He understood then what the maize garden had been teaching him his entire life. The maze was not a maze for him to walk through. The maze was a defensive geometry, a slow, careful structure that the gardener uncles had been growing for 300 years to make the palace approachable only by people who would not hurry. He had always thought the maze was beautiful. It was beautiful. It was also a kingdom protecting its king by being slow on purpose, by being impossible to rush through, by forcing every visitor to move the way he had been taught to move.
one careful step at a time, one hedge at a time, one path at a time. The cannot enter check rule was not an arbitrary prohibition. It was the same rule the maze enforced. You do not walk into the danger. You stop one square short of it. You let the others step in for you if they can. If they cannot, you go around. But you do not walk in. He had been practicing the rule for 37 years, and had not, until that morning at the bench in the maze center, understood that he had been practicing it. The understanding did not change the practice. It only named it. He wrote one sentence, in his even hand, before he went inside to call the general. "Cousin, I have just been asked to reinforce my eastern crossing. I will do it. I am also sorry." The two letters crossed in the post. The reinforcements arrived on both sides. The outposts both held. The river crossing did not change hands, which is to say, it did not change hands in either direction, which is to say, both armies fought to a tired standstill, and several hundred soldiers went home that spring who otherwise had not. Neither king has ever told this story publicly. Pumble, when asked about the bad winter, says, "It was cold." Sable, when asked about the bad winter, says, "It was cold for everyone." But each year, on the anniversary of those two letters that crossed in the post, both kings independently write each other an extra Sunday letter. Always the same one. It says, "Still here. Still sorry. Still writing." The letters are short. They do not need to be long. Each is one careful step, taken once a year, by a king who learned at 37 what the king rule actually was.
Back in the academy hall, this morning, the children have asked about the bad winter only obliquely. They have asked instead about Sunday letters and cheekbones, and how it can possibly be that two kings are also cousins, which is a question whose answer is technically simple and emotionally not. Captain Castle has answered some of the questions himself, in his short way. The kings have answered the rest. Now, for the last 10 minutes of the visit, Captain Castle pushes himself off the doorframe and walks to the chalkboard. "Both of you," he says to the kings, with affection, "show them how a king moves." Pumble stands. He smooths the front of his green coat, a gesture he has been making, by his own private count, since he was 9. He looks at the square tiles of the academy hall floor, and he takes one careful step from his throne towards the chalkboard. He pauses. He takes one more. He pauses. He takes one more. 6 steps. 6 pauses. He arrives at the chalkboard. He turns. He bows slightly to the children, the way he bows to his apprentices every morning when they enter the library. "That," he says, "is a king's morning walk. It is also a king's afternoon walk, and, if I am being honest about it, a king's evening walk." The children laugh, quietly. Sable stands. He does not smooth anything. He does not adjust his coat. He simply walks the same 6 careful steps from his throne to the chalkboard. He pauses between each one. He arrives. He stands next to Pumble. He does not bow. He nods at the children with the same nod he uses for the gardeners when they arrive in the morning, which is the only nod he has. "That," he says, "is the same morning walk, in a different garden." Captain Castle taps the chalkboard, 1 square at a time, any direction, never 2 squares in one move. That is how every king in this game moves, on every turn, for every kingdom, in every match. He turns to the kings. "Now show them check." Pumble and Sable look at each other. They have done this before. They know the choreography. Sable takes 1 careful step forward, towards Pumble. Pumble looks at the space between them, and at the place his foot would land if he kept walking towards Sable. He does not take the step. He stops. He turns. He takes 1 careful step to the side instead, out of the line that Sable's step has drawn. "That," Captain Castle says, "is what a king does when he cannot enter check. He stops before the danger. He goes around. He does not walk in. Not ever. Not even when he is angry. Not even when he is brave. The king stops." The children think about this. Several of them look at their own feet, the way they had earlier, and then look up at the kings as if reconsidering some private question about cowardice and bravery, and which of the two looks like which from a distance. Captain Castle taps the chalkboard once more. "And now," he says, "the last thing about the king." Pumble walks 1 careful step back towards his throne. Sable walks 1 careful step back towards his. Captain Castle reaches into his coat and produces a small cluster of pawn pieces, 8 of them, which he sets on the floor around the 2 thrones in a loose circle, each pawn between the kings and the children. Back in the academy hall, this morning, the children have asked about the bad winter only obliquely. They have asked instead about Sunday letters and cheekbones, and how it can possibly be that two kings are also cousins, which is a question whose answer is technically simple and emotionally not. Captain Castle has answered some of the questions himself, in his short way. The kings have answered the rest. Now, for the last 10 minutes of the visit, Captain Castle pushes himself off the doorframe and walks to the chalkboard. "Both of you," he says to the kings, with affection, "show them how a king moves." Pumble stands. He smooths the front of his green coat, a gesture he has been making, by his own private count, since he was 9. He looks at the square tiles of the Academy Hall floor, and he takes one careful step from his throne towards the chalkboard. He pauses. He takes one more. He pauses. He takes one more. 6 steps. 6 pauses. He arrives at the chalkboard. He turns. He bows slightly to the children, the way he bows to his apprentices every morning when they enter the library. "That," he says, "is a king's morning walk. It is also a king's afternoon walk, and, if I am being honest about it, a king's evening walk." The children laugh, quietly. Sable stands. He does not smooth anything. He does not adjust his coat. He simply walks the same 6 careful steps from his throne to the chalkboard. He pauses between each one. He arrives. He stands next to Pumble. He does not bow. He nods at the children with the same nod he uses for the gardeners when they arrive in the morning, which is the only nod he has. "That," he says, "is the same morning walk, in a different garden." Captain Castle taps the chalkboard, 1 square at a time, any direction. Never 2 squares in one move. That is how every king in this game moves, on every turn, for every kingdom, in every match. He turns to the kings. "Now show them check." Pumble and Sable look at each other. They have done this before. They know the choreography. Sable takes 1 careful step forward, towards Pumble. Pumble looks at the space between them, and at the place his foot would land if he kept walking towards Sable. He does not take the step. He stops. He turns. He takes 1 careful step to the side instead, out of the line that Sable's step has drawn. "That," Captain Castle says, "is what a king does when he cannot enter check. He stops before the danger. He goes around. He does not walk in. Not ever. Not even when he is angry. Not even when he is brave. The king stops." The children think about this. Several of them look at their own feet, the way they had earlier, and then look up at the kings as if reconsidering some private question about cowardice and bravery, and which of the two looks like which from a distance. Captain Castle taps the chalkboard once more. "And now," he says, "the last thing about the king." Pumble walks 1 careful step back towards his throne. Sable walks 1 careful step back towards his. Captain Castle reaches into his coat and produces a small cluster of pawn pieces, 8 of them, which he sets on the floor around the 2 thrones in a loose circle, each pawn between the kings and the children. "The pawns," he says, "stand where they stand because the king is behind them. The bishops sweep, the knights jump, the rooks march, the queen runs. They do all that for the kings. The kings move 1 careful step at a time and never into danger, because the kings are the piece every other piece is protecting. Lose the king and the game ends. So the king moves carefully. So the king lets the others move fast. That is the trade. That is the rule. That is the whole game in one sentence." He turns to the kings. "Cousins, one more time, together." Pumble and Sable walk 1 careful step towards the children, then stop. They walk 1 step back. They sit down on their thrones. They look across at each other, across the foot of empty space between the chairs. The girl with the fork pin in her hair says, "So you both move slowly, all the time, on purpose." "Yes," says Pumble. "Yes," says Sable. "And you can't help each other on the board." "No," says Pumble, more quietly. "No," says Sable. "But you write letters on Sundays." Pumble looks at Sable. Sable looks at Pumble. Sable lifts the single eyebrow again, the eyebrow that has, over the years, become the most reliable expressive instrument either of them possesses. "Yes," says Pumble. "We write letters on Sundays, 1 careful sentence at a time mostly, at least for one of us. On Sundays, we are not opposite kings. On Sundays, we are just 2 old men who have been moving slowly together for a long time. The board doesn't get those Sundays. The board only gets the weekdays. We keep the rest." The children file out for the next class. Pumble waves at them as they go. Sable raises 1 hand. Captain Castle, standing by the door, watches the kings. They sit in their thrones for 1 quiet moment longer, side by side, looking at each other across the foot of empty space. Then Pumble stands. He takes 1 careful step towards the door, then another. Sable follows, 1 careful step behind, the way he has been following the small, steady gravity of his cousin's particular brand of nervousness for 62 years now. Across the river, the scrolls are waiting on the long oak table.
Across the river, the topiary is waiting at the bench at the maze's center. The two kings will go back to work this afternoon, the way they go back to work every afternoon, the way they have been going back to work since they were children, the way they will go back to work until they cannot. The grandmother, who was right about most things, was right about this. One is loud and one is quiet, and they will both move one careful step at a time, and so will their kingdoms. One step, always deliberate. Same step, different garden, different boards, same king roll. The letter game is still going. Sunday is in 3 days. And on both sides of the river, when each old cousin thinks of the other picking up a pen that morning, something quiet and warm settles in his chest. The steady, unhurried comfort of knowing that slow as they both are, they have never once stopped reaching for each other.
You've been listening to a Spark and Anvil chapter, written by the Spark and Anvil writing team for ages 9 to 14. Spark and Anvil is a 501c3 public charity. Apps stay free forever. Curriculum aligned to King Pumble and King Sable. Released under Creative Commons BYNCSA 4.0 for educational reuse. Visit Spark and Anvil for the full transcript.